There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
The spawn of time is ignorant. A fool of epic style and swagger, braying out the morning of clear tolling bells which signify the caprice of coin and the anger of the bill. What wroth the savage knave? Where has the truth in ignorance won foothold against the treacherous standing of lost horizons? We answer only with that which costs us nothing. Beware, fellow listeners! What hark, followers of the drunken beasts of the Nevermind! For there is nothing in this path that cannot be found in the pockets of youth, the song of rain, or the sadness that is the circus. All of which is to say, Max Mike Movies! We're back!
Crazy, Daddy-O, crazy.
Trust me, that is themic, and you'll see why. We're back with another episode of our series on Roger Corman, Be Like the Corman.
Corman.
This week, it's an older movie of his, a black and white from the 50s called Bucket of Blood.
Dun, dun, dun.
But is it? Here to make Hepcat rhymes, sling the arrows of misfortune in low budgets is Max Skin Me Man Levine. Slip me some jive, Max.
I saw the best bands of my time turned to small quivering cubes of jello that formed themselves into a single dinosaur.
What flavor?
Raspberry.
And I bang bongos to his great annoyance, for I am Mike Velvet Smog Loose. The next segment is usually set aside for the poll question, but we're going to slip this in just because.
Listener mail.
We got a letter this week. It's from past contributor F.J. Halbwitz. So nice to hear from you again, Halb. He wrote into...
Guten Tag, Herr Halbwitz.
He wrote into... Wait. Mm-hmm. To praise our recent sponsor, Maison de Velour. Let him explain. Gentlemen's. Sponsors just love it when listeners buy their stuff, so I'm writing to praise Maison de Velour's fine grape-flavored wine beverage product. After a shopping trip to Big Junior's Liquor and Auto Parts in scenic Everett, Mass., I got a little confused and poured the Maison de Velour into the gas tank instead of into me. But I still have to say, this stuff is great. My 1983 Yugo is now running better than it ever has, with improved fuel economy and performance. In fact, I was pulled over for speeding on Starro Drive, but the statey just looked at my car, smacked his radar gun a couple of times, and sent me on my way. So tell your listeners to try pouring one of the convenient plastic pint bottles into their gas tank once a week. It is, without a doubt, the finest carburetor cleaner I have ever tasted. Maison de Velour, it's not just for drinking. Well, you certainly can't argue with that. Not just for drinking, indeed. Makes an excellent pairing with Science Crazed. Trust me on that. Thanks, FJ. Always nice to hear from you.
He's good.
Speaking of hearing from you, here's some more of hearing from you.
Poll question.
Last show, we were dying to know what movies you thought were total genre game changers. You said this. Angelo Potsalis wrote, quote, Spaceballs, Blue Lagoon, and Somewhere in Time, end quote. When asked what genres these changed, he replied, quote, comedy and drama, end quote. I have literally never seen a sentence with those three films in it together.
Wow, that's unique.
Yeah. Thanks, Angelo.
Yeah.
My transmission's magnetized. That's a personal deeper. Adam Mark,
who knows all, sees all,
sent us, quote, just what was in that gold glowing briefcase? I'm going to go with Pulp Fiction 1994, celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Crime gangster films had been made since forever, but they were formulaic and often interchangeable, their budgets low, and their writing and production cheap, or pulp. Pulp Fiction threw a brick through the window of the genre. Even today, watching it just feels fresh. I feel fresh.
Quentin Tarantino. I sometimes feel less than fresh.
Quentin Tarantino charged it with intellectual coolness and humor, with intoxicating and very adult writing, realistic dialogue, clever and strategic use of music, and long, eloquent, almost Shakespearean soliloquies. Samuel L. Jackson in particular. Wow, just wow. Pulp Fiction marked the birth of the postmodern blockbuster. It also initiated a new wave of independent film. Without Pulp Fiction, there is likely no Wes Anderson, no Paul Thomas Anderson, no Guy Ritchie, no Diablo Cody, no Greta Gerwig, and no Sopranos, no Breaking Bad, and no Curb Your Enthusiasm. 3 decades wow. on, we all still live in Quentin Tarantino's world, end quote. What's in the briefcase? I heard it was Golden Grahams. Thanks, Adam. Always nice to hear from you.
Very intriguing.
Yeah. Next was Dave, whose perspective was, quote, one expects film to evolve over time. Mostly, it is a matter of adapting to new audiences. So it feels to me not like the genre is being changed or bent, but more like they are doing something the under 20s have never seen before, and that speaks to them, though I suppose that Pulp Fiction, loved it, catered to the baby boomers. I also think there are films that are canonical in that people look to them for inspiration as to how to make their own movies. So I like to watch films that are recognized as having influenced later work. Mostly, though, it feels like attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. I knew I was living in a new world when I saw Snow Falling on Cedars, a movie that is supposed to be aesthetically pleasing and romantic, yet it has so much going on, much of which was unnecessary, presumably because they didn't want the VHS audience to fast forward. I loved the movie, but it was so much busier than it needed to be, and I thought, so this is what Hollywood thinks of as Zen pacing after MTV. They should watch some Ozu, end quote. He always has an interesting view, and Ozu, as you know, is the Pakuni word for water. Thanks, Dave.
No, it's not. It's one of those Greek liquors. Tastes like licorice.
That's ouzo. And whatever. Technically, it's Osu for water, but yes. I'm sure Ozu is some sort of Japanese film, but thanks, Dave. Roland Hardy posted, quote, 2001 A Space Odyssey. The varied levels of the scenes had meaning of life for me, end quote. Interesting. Thanks, Roland. Val Coons, who stomps grapes for Maison de Velour, offered, quote, there are two for me for very different reasons. One is The Maltese Falcon. The artistry of the cinematography blew me away, and the characters and story ignited a passion for noir that is still very strong today, as you well know. The other one is Willow. I'm sure I'd seen other fantasy films before that one, but that's the one that made the genre stick in my heart and pursue other avenues of fantasy, like The Labyrinth Ball I play a character in every year, end quote. Well, I can't argue. Well, I can, but I won't argue with those. Thanks, Val.
Interesting.
I honestly don't think there has been the fantasy film, even with Lord of the Rings, because it's an adaptation. I don't think there's been like Star Wars is the science space opera film. I don't know if I can point to one fantasy film that I would go, yeah, that. But that's just
me. I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, remember our entire series on D&D and movies, or whatever we call it. Keith Wright, actor in the Q Footsteps podcast, wrote, quote, I'm going to go with Galaxy Quest. Not a game changer in the sci-fi genre, but a great mix of sci-fi and comedy. I have one job on this vessel, and I'm damn well going to do it. A paraphrase of the fabulous Sigourney Weaver, XOXO.
Incredible impression.
You like that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jones, you naughty cat. Naughty, naughty Jones. And a big XOXO to you too, Keith. Dr. Rebecca Pelkey responded, quote, I was never a horror fan, but the first The Cabin in the Woods and later Get Out and His House on Netflix, and going back to a few classics like Alien and Night of the Living Dead, convinced me that horror was doing a lot more work than I had thought. I still don't love all the subgenres, but I won't automatically write off a film in that genre either, end quote. Thanks, Becca.
Yeah.
See our entire episode on Night of the Living Dead. Charles Forsyth writes, quote, Plan 9 from Outer Space, end quote. Okay. He continues, quote, I'd actually sought it out because I'd read about it in Harry and Michael Medved's The Golden Turkey Awards. It was the beginning of a lifelong enjoyment of so bad they're good movies. Still haven't had an opportunity to enjoy Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS, but it's on the list, end quote. I see what you did there.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Enjoy is still not the word I would use for that particular film. Thanks, Charles.
George, that's a bold choice.
Good for him.
Yeah.
George Saulnier answered, quote, I gotta say I'm not really drawn to films based on genre. I use genre for exclusion. If a film is trying too much to fit into a certain genre mold, I'm more likely to avoid it because it will be too formulaic for me. I don't like facing a streaming service's list of genres, end quote. Okay.
Okay, thanks, that's fair. George.
It's kind of not answering the question, but okay.
Yeah.
Degsy O'Brien was last on Facebook with, quote, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Western. I was raised on old-style Westerns, courtesy of my father, who would only accept John Wayne, Gary Cooper, or Burt Lancaster as cowboy heroes, where everyone's clothes and faces were clean and morals were as black and white as the hats. But Sergio Leone's 1966 epic threw all that away. Everyone was grimy, stubbly, probably smelly. The bloodshots were red and copious. Everyone double-crossed everyone. Any of the titular actors could be good, bad, or ugly. And flies buzzed around like they were being paid to scale. That it was also funny, brutal, sprawling, and well-acted didn't hurt either, end quote. Not only listen to our entire episode on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, but thanks, Degsy.
Yeah, very nicely put.
Yeah. Last up is Vince over to the website where, between carving igloos for indigent penguins, answered our little question thusly. Quote, in sci-fi, 2001 changed how I viewed the genre and saw how amazing and serious it could be. I have to say, Snow White really changed how we experienced animation in a similar way.
Sure.
It was one of the first feature-length animations and showed that cartoons were also art and could appeal to all ages. Christopher Reeve in Superman also showed comic book material was not as niche as many thought and opened up comic book characters to cinema in a way that it had never done before. It hasn't aged well in some ways, but those effects were amazing at the time and made way for much of the films we see now, end quote. He also said, and I quote, you are both fired, end quote. Seems he was taken in by our little joke last week.
Aren't we a naughty pair?
Naughty we are. Thanks, Vince. But the only person who has the power to fire anyone is me. And by the way, Max fired again.
Yeah. Oh, damn it!
Before you go, Max, what movie is a big genre changer for you?
Why should I tell you I'm fired?
Because I won't rehire you otherwise. You'll get all that big pony money.
Oh, yeah. I gotta say, I'm with Vince on Superman. That really changed the whole superhero movie genre in that it pretty much defined it for a long time. And it took it from the sort of goofy serials or terrible, you know, 70s Spider-Man TV show, Incredible Hulk.
Yeah. The Hulk did surprisingly well in the ratings. I think it might even have been up for some Emmys.
It was, and they made like 3 made-for-TV movies after it was canceled.
And it gave Bill Bixby something to do.
Yes, it did. Yes, and he was no longer Mr. Eddie's father.
Right.
Yeah. I got to go with that. That was a big genre changer for me. What about you?
I'm going to go with one that kind of also didn't really change a genre, but kind of started it. And it wasn't just a movie genre. And you probably see this coming. It's Blade Runner.
Sure.
When that came out, we had never seen anything like it. I think that the music, too, was especially different for its time. There have been science fiction soundtracks in the past I can point to, such as Andromeda Strain and Forbidden Planet, which were also very cutting edge. But the music for Blade Runner and the look, the style, and if you watch the right cut, the approach of like not treating the audience like they're idiots and basically saying, oh, by the way, cyberpunk, all at the same time, really worked for me. Another one, which didn't really change the genre, but showed to me things you could do with film that you couldn't do with the original genre, it was Moulin Rouge. I love Moulin Rouge, and the way it's depicted is not a way you could do it on stage. Most other movie musicals pretty much look like you stuck the camera in the theater and just aimed at the stage and that was it.
Oh, I wouldn't agree with that. I think there are a bunch that aren't like that.
A lot of times. The one that came out the year after, which was Chicago, I didn't think was anything interesting at all. It was, they totally wasted the idea that it was on film to me. And occasionally, like in The Greatest Show on Earth, you'll get at least, you know, animals and circus stuff, right? Because that was a great
West Side musical. Story, they actually used the city as the set. A lot of the dance numbers in that, where they're leaping over garbage cans and going through buildings, is very impressive.
It is very impressive, but it didn't feel to me like they were using film to its ultimate abilities. Like, they weren't adding elements and stuff that you literally couldn't do on stage. They expanded what they were doing, but they didn't feel like they were really going crazy and all the extra stuff. I don't know. I really like the film. I know it is kind of a lot. It's a film that a lot of people don't like. I was also willing to believe for a short time that Ewan McGregor could sing.
He can sing. It's just, yeah. You know, it's not what he should do with his life.
I think he did fine. Could there have been somebody better?
Perfectly sure. Adequate.
Yeah. I also think he did a good job acting it. But anyway, that's his maybe, and we still have more shows to come, and we need you. Riddle me this, Caped Crusaders. What genre do you think mixes best with comedy? Horror, drama, sci-fi? Answer us, won't you? But first, there's this.
The facts.
Trivia. Remember, we're talking about Bucket of Blood. I know it's been a while.
Bucket of Blood. Yep.
Yeah. Budget, 50,000 kabukis.
And it only took 5 days to shoot. How much is that in American money?
Nothing. Kabukis are pancakes. And it only took 5 days to shoot. Take 180,000. So percentage-wise, a rousing success.
Still makes money.
Yeah. Corman and Griffith took only 1 day to come up with the concept for this film. Amazing!
I'm shocked, I tell you.
Hey, do these sets feel even a teensy bit familiar? Well, yes. They are, as Corman would use them again in Little Shop of Horrors, and they were originally built for another American international film, Diary of a High School Bride.
Yeah, the sets aren't the only thing he reused.
Well, we'll get to that, I'm sure. Yeah. In the did they really think this through department? It seems that a promotional gimmick for this movie ran in the papers stating that if you brought a bucket of real blood to the theater, you'd get one free admission. Yuck.
Oh, yeah. I'm curious to know how many people tried to take advantage of that.
I'm not curious at all.
I wonder if they, well, at least they didn't specify human blood.
Who's going to check? Dick Miller, one of Corman's stable of steadies, thought this film could have really gone somewhere if not for the low budget. He said, quote, if they'd had more money to put into production so we didn't have to use mannequins for the statues, if we didn't have to shoot the last scene with me hanging with just some gray makeup on because they didn't have time to put the plaster on me, this could have been a very classic little film. The story was good, the acting was good, the humor in it was good, the timing was right, everything about it was right, but they didn't have any money for production values, and it suffered, end quote. Was he right? We'll see.
We'll get to that.
Speaking of old Dick, usually he was a bit player, getting smaller parts or cameos. This was one of only 3 starring roles, the others being Rock All Night and War of the Satellites, both Corman-driven films. Still talking about Dick. Let that sink in. This is one of 10 roles where his character's first name was Walter, last name was Paisley, or both.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's sort of a signature, okay.
Yeah, and they weren't all Corman films either.
Huh.
Yeah. This might be one of the few actual depictions of the Beat lifestyle, even if it's also something of a parody. Corman and longtime screenwriter Charles B. Griffith went to many Sunset Strip coffee houses to soak in the culture.
Huh.
There was go ahead.
I thought that, I mean, there was an actual movie called The Beatniks.
Yes, you've seen it. It's on MST, and there is not one beatnik in it.
No, there are, as they say, not even boatniks.
Yeah. No. There was, wait for it, a stage musical adaptation of this film done in 2009 in Chicago.
Really?
Apparently it wasn't as successful as the other musical Corman adaptation, but it actually got excellent reviews and is under development under the title Beatsville. And wait, there was a second musical adaptation. In 2023, La Mirada Theater put on a show with the same characters, the same plot, though it was titled, Did You See What Walter Paisley Did Today? It ran less than a month.
It's a better title, actually.
And amazingly, there was a remake of this done for TV back in 1995. It was directed by Michael McDonald and had cameos by David Cross, Mink Stoll, and Will Ferrell.
Good Lord!
I know! This is considered one of the very first slasher movies, even though nothing is actually slashed. Yeah. The movie is considered satire and chooses as its subjects abstract art, the beat culture, low-budget teen films of the times in general, and Corman's own films in particular. As proof that this was meant to be a comedy, the movie posters declared that you would be sick, sick, sick from laughing. This was apparently a reference to a Jules Pfeiffer Village Voice comic strip and the name of his book by the same title. Our budget for trivia ran out about here, unless you have anything... We should get to the plot.
Yes, I got one thing, although I know it's technically about the cast, but it still just kind of killed me. The art collector?
Yep.
If you want to call him that.
Oh, God, he's been in everything.
He has been in everything, but especially that he was Dave in Attack of the Giant Leeches.
He's also one of the corral of favorites.
Yeah.
I had him in my notes, too. It's like, oh, it's that guy. Apparently his name is Bruno Visoda. But
yep,
we'll get back to the cast. All right, plot.
Now, that's it, all I got. Let's have the plot,
Plot. Mm. Walter Paisley is a waiter at a beatnik coffee shop somewhere in California. The place is a center for beat culture, having poetry readings, weird jazz music, coffee, that anti-establishment drawl, and of course, avant-garde art. Walter, a waiter there, is lacking in taste, intelligence, and really anything except his honest love for all things going on around him. He's desperate to be a part of it, but it's obvious that waiter is about as far as he's going to go. When he gets home that night, he hears a neighbor's cat trapped in the wall. Trying to free it, he accidentally stabs it instead, killing it. Afraid to expose his mistake, he instead encases the dead cat and knife in clay, then brings them to cafe the next day, declaring it an artwork. Oddly, everyone seems to like it, including Carla, the woman Walter has a secret crush on. Ooh. Declared an artist, it only remains to see what Walter is going to sculpt next. A chance run-in with the law provides his next subject as Walter, once again, accidentally kills a cop trying to bust Walter for drugs he didn't even know he had. Once again, he encases his victim in clay and proclaims this another work of art. The success has gone to his head, and soon, Walter is looking at the world in a totally different way. Anyone wronging him might be a new subject. Only one person has figured it out, Walter's boss, Leonard, but he's keeping his mouth shut as he sees if there's a way for him to profit out of this. Finally, with four sculptures and an art show in the cafe, things have gone too far, especially when Carla discovers there's a real body beneath the clay of one of the statues. The cops bust in, seeking Walter's head. Seeing no way out, Walter flees to his home where he makes himself his final work, covering himself in clay and hanging himself. Loads of laughs! The end.
Ta! The film!
So!
Yeah.
It wasn't what I was thinking it was going to be about. What about you?
Nope, I was expecting a straight-up slasher movie, and I guess this is supposed to sort of be a slasher movie despite a complete absence of, you know, slashing.
Yeah.
Although I guess you could count the buzzsaw murder.
Well, and the funny thing is that that's not where we get the blood. There is a titular bucket of blood, but it's mostly in the background and doesn't really...
Yeah, he's using it to catch blood falling from the corpse of Bert Convy, who has been stuffed into the rafters.
I saw that name pop up in the credits. I'm like, what? Bert Convy? I was like,
this must be another Bert Convy. No,
it's Bert Convy.
It is Bert. I make my living through guest starring on various TV shows. Convy.
Yeah, or game shows. Yeah.
Game shows, yeah.
He was like the 70s guest actor. He was in everything, and he was always smooth and suave, and that perm.
Utterly forgettable.
I remember, but I honestly couldn't point to a particular role.
See?
It's like, oh, yeah, he was in Mary Tyler Moore Show once as, actually, I do
Bert
remember.
Bert Convy.
That's Bert Convy. He does not have a wide range, let's face it, but he had that innate 70s-ishness that took him through the 70s. I'm sure he was on Love Boat at least once, Fantasy Island at least once. I mean, basically, if there was a 70s sitcom or drama of any kind, he was there at some point. Mm-hmm. He just was. But he's not even close to the top of this list because he dies fairly soon on. Oops, spoiler.
In the 1970s, if you had a TV show, Bert Convy just magically appeared.
Always wearing a purple velvet blazer.
Yeah, I think so.
So
but
weird.
Let's get to like the star.
Dick Miller.
Dick Miller.
I gotta say, this is a big range change for him from the other roles we've seen. He usually plays kind of a tough, snide guy, and here he's like, he's actually playing his height because I never realized how short he was.
Dick Miller is not a towering gentleman. He has a fair amount of presence.
Yeah.
So it's not always obvious. But here they really play into it, not to mention the fact they're surrounding him with much taller actors.
And I, all things considered, I think he does a credible job.
It's a little over the top. And by the way, he cannot play drunk at all.
Well, I thought that's really
hard to do. I know that's not fair. It's very difficult to play drunk on screen or on stage. He's really bad at it.
I actually thought when he got drunk, he reminded me a lot of Jack Lemmon, at least facially. He was doing you know, Jack Lemmon expressions or something. I don't know if it's
Jack
on purpose,
Lemmon, but it mugs a great deal, and that's what he was doing.
I can play Jack.
Yeah.
I, for the part, here's the thing that was weird. When I first picked the film, I didn't realize it was supposed to be a comedy. I'm still not sure.
I would question that that descriptor.
But I would say that it was the idea behind it. And to that point, I have to give Dick Miller a little credit because I think he was trying to play it the way that they wanted it perceived. I don't perceive it that way. I think Little Shop of Horrors takes it a step further and is a little bit more obviously a comedy, but I think he was doing what he was asked. And again, as we pointed out, whatever you want to say about Roger Corman, he tends to get decent performances out of his actors. So
yeah, he was all right.
How about Barbara Morris?
Well, first of all, what was with her, the way she spells her name? You know, her name's Barbara, and it's B-A-R-B-O-U-R-A.
You don't know it's not Barbora.
I'm willing to take a chance.
Well, she's so good, she doesn't even have a photo on IMDb.
Yeah.
She's fine.
She's there. She is another of Corman's actresses, meaning she doesn't get much to do.
No.
She's mostly supposed to look horrified and occasionally scream and sort of be nice to the main character or treat them horribly. That's what women in Corman movies tend to do. Yeah.
Like, he thinks Roger Corman doth protest too much.
could be. She's, you know, there.
Yeah.
That's about the best you can say.
Anthony Carbone, I gotta admit, when he wasn't wearing the beret, I didn't know who he was.
Had no clue. He looked, I mean, it's kind of hard. He's wearing a three-piece suit and a beret, and we're supposed to think he's bohemian.
Maybe for California, because it's so hot, wearing a beret is anti-step. I don't know.
I don't, yeah, no idea.
I honestly could not figure out the motivation for that character.
He was confusing. I mean, he was conflicted, but then he wouldn't be, then he was, and he kept, like, almost fainting. Like, yeah. I don't know if we were supposed to think, because he's always using a cane. Is he supposed to be ill? Is he have a delicate constitution? We don't know. Well, he just... Or does the actor just want to sit down a lot?
Well, and it's funny because it's in the trivia that most people assumed that Corman was like, I need a guy who's got a limp and a cane. I'll just hire one because that's what Roger Corman does. But no, the actor actually picked up that limp and that cane as an affectation to help make the character more interesting. I honestly think part
didn't
of...
Didn't work, did it?
Try your Punami stone. I honestly think in this case, a lot of the trouble comes from the writing because we don't know where he's coming. He's the one who discovers the cat is a real cat and it freaks him out. But he doesn't run to the police and tell them or even his friends and tell them, nor does he kick Walter out of the club.
He starts to go to the cops. He's ready to call the cops, and then suddenly this guy starts offering him big money for the sculpture, and he's like, wait, how much?
So he goes along with it because he can make money. In fact, he does rip Walter off. But he also then later on is like really freaked out again, and he was just not written very well. I can't tell if the guy was a decent actor. I think he's okay. I'm not going to go out on a limb. And then we started to get into the, besides Bert Convy, he's honestly, it's the 50s. He's exactly the same. He is the Bert Convy.
Looks the same. Yep. Every performance is the same. He never changed.
Nope.
20 years.
If that's what you want, the same. He is really good at it. But he doesn't last very long. There's not a lot of other performances that have a lot of screen time.
There's a bunch of them are like bit players or almost cameos. I mean, you got the Julian Burton as Maxwell Brock of H&L Brock.
Yeah.
The supposed beat god,
Maxwell, poet. Well, you know, I actually think he fills that bill quite well. It's exactly what you expect to see a beat poet to look like and act
like. He's very cartoonish, but that is how mainstream America saw the beat poets. You can see there's an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies that I remember, which they paraphrase as the Beverly Hill Hippies, where they run into a bunch of hippies and a few leftover beat poets. And they're done exactly the same way. This is just sort of the Hollywood idea of what beat was.
I honestly think it's not far off the mark.
We don't really know.
That's the problem. There's actually very little like visual representation of actual beat stuff, which is why I said what I did in the trivia. It's like they actually went, they wanted, apparently being there suggested a lot of the film to them. And honestly, that's why I think we get confused as to whether it's comedy or not, because it's presented straight, which is one of the things that they were told, if you want to do comedy, you have to do it straight. I think there's just something inherently funny about beat culture, which is not supposed to be funny, but kind of is.
At least that portrayal of it. We don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise,
I mean, that's where most of the comedy comes from, is from these bit players. It's from him and from those two weirdos in the hats. One guy's wearing like a Union soldier hat.
Yeah.
And one's wearing a...
I honestly think they're the closest to the real beats as there were, because they're like just this close to becoming hippies, because beat culture did not last. It was like five years. It was literally nothing. And then it became the hippies of the 60s once, of course, Vietnam became a thing. But
just some of their data. Didn't you hear him? No, man, I'm too far out. What?
I assumed he was high. Because they don't talk about the weedly deedly, but I think it's...
Yeah, they don't talk about weed, but by God, they talk about heroin.
Yeah.
Which is the weirdest looking heroin I have ever seen.
It is.
Yep.
Peppermint flavored heroin. That's a deeper.
Yeah, yeah.
We have the return of Myrtle Vale as Mrs. Swickert, last seen in Little Shop of Horrors as the annoying landlady.
Mrs. Shiva. Yeah. Oh, no, as Mrs. Shiva
I think it's the same.
Or as Seymour's mother.
I think it's Seymour's mother.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's
doing what she does, which is an annoying busybody
stereotype,
two-dimensional.
I mean, quite honestly, it's $50,000, which even in the 50s was nothing. So the rest of the actors are I don't think anybody's bad. I don't think anybody really stands out. I will say I think Dick Miller is actually showing some range, which considering he's one of Roger Corman's stable of stars, whatever you want to call it, is kind of remarkable, but it's not a performance that you're going to go, wow, that Dick Miller.
No.
Remember him from Rock and Roll High School? Because he is in that.
He is. Yes, he is. This is the big time, girly. This is rock and roll. Joey, what did the doctor tell you? No pizza for you. You got to have more wheat germ, more riboflavin. Sorry, he has some of my favorite lines.
Well, that's one of the other Ramones. That's his the manager. No. That's not Dick Miller.
The manager. Oh, okay.
Dick Miller plays the chief of police. But the funny thing is, he's doing the exact same facial expressions in 1980 as he was doing in 1959. So there you go. So yeah, the cast is fine. It's a Roger Corman film. They're fine.
It's a standard Roger Corman level of acting, which is like set it on mediocre.
I don't think that's fair. I'm going to say set it on adequate. I think they're
is that different than mediocre?
Mediocre means adequate's like they're fine. Nobody stands out. Nobody's terrible. They're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. For average, I'm going to say average Corman performances with a plus added for a couple of people. That's it. So like C plus here and there.
Okay.
I want to say adequate. You can say mediocre if you want. I'm going to go with adequate. Trust me, there's a line there somewhere. And I hope someday to cross it. I actually do really want to go to one of those coffee houses. I desperately want to go to an actual coffee. Heck, I want to go to any nightclub depicted from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I wanted to go to one of the ones where everyone's dressed up all fancy, and the waiters all have accents from 9 different countries, and they're bringing you champagne cocktails, and everyone's dancing, and everyone's gorgeous. Those look so... I wonder if those ever really existed.
They're so prevalent. I have to assume that they did, but they're...
There's
no way
them.
That's ever coming back. Although I will say, I was recently in Atlanta, and there were restaurants that had a dress code. And if you didn't have a tie, they were like, don't bother. Like even on their website, they're like, if you don't have this minimum, and women don't look like this, don't bother. Don't come in. And they're just restaurants. They weren't even like nightclubs. So maybe, but who wouldn't like to sit down to a nice cocktail, a nice dinner and some great entertainment? If you could see somebody like, I don't know, Eartha Kitt or something like that, that would be awesome. Why don't we have that?
Yeah.
I want to go to the coffee house with the beats in it. I want to see real beats. There's a coffee house in Bell Book and Candle I would dearly love to go to, the Zodiac Club.
Yeah.
And yep. It's like, I didn't know what the guy, the French guy, was singing about. When I found out he was singing about it, it's like, oh, it's a guy singing about drowning. That's awesome. But I want to, I miss that kind of thing. And so it's nice to see that representation and make me interested, at least in that part. I will say, as much as I wanted to give Dick Miller a pass, I have to say my note for him was, oh, he's the Gilligan of Bucket of Blood.
I have, he's the Seymour Prelboyne, or a proto-Seymour Prelboyne. Because this movie, let us face it, Corman not only used the same sets, he used the same story. It's the same thing, a nebbishy, misunderstood, socially awkward guy, utter failure, finds one thing that makes him admired, but it requires murder. Guy has his boss, tries to exploit him, but eventually can't deal with it. And eventually, he is killed by, in effect, by the thing that made him admired. It's Seymour, it's the plant. With Walter, it's his stat. He tries to apparently make himself into a statue when he hangs himself. Although I got to tell you, from that shot, it's not. It just looks like he fell face first into some makeup.
I don't even think he fell face first.
I know they didn't have to. Yeah, chin first, maybe. Yeah, but yeah, it's the same story. There's even the chase at the end.
Well,
running through, it's even running through, I think, the same lumberyard.
I want to say that that's probably a little bit of Corman padding that we've come to know and love, having watched his movies.
I wouldn't be surprised if some of it's the same footage, but yeah, it's the same movie. It's exactly the same plot.
I will say this. I'm not going to disagree with you, but I didn't notice it when I was watching the film, partially because in this case, I actually felt, because of the way he was becoming a sculptor, there was almost a Poe-like quality to the story. There was that, the touch of horror in here was way more believable as horror than it was in...
Well, yes, than a talking sentient plant. I mean, it doesn't even sing.
If it had sung...
it sang, that would be different. So, but no, though, that part is, it's more realistic, and it's not as... attempting to be, apparently it's supposed to be funny, but Little Shop was way more over the top in terms of its attempt at comedy.
Well, this is a character eats flowers. It's the same idea. That's, you know.
Yeah. There's no absurdity, or not really any absurdity in this. It's going more for sort of realism.
And I want to say, too, that if you rewrote this as straight horror, and apparently this was also really... what's the word, influenced by House of Wax with Vincent Price, which is like, okay.
sure, okay.
Well, that's okay, because Vincent Price would eventually become another one of these stable of stars. I would have to say that if you rewrote this as period horror, it really could come off as either like a Lovecraft or Poe-like story. You know, a guy who was like, I can't find my artistic voice, so I started encasing people in them. Of course, how he fires his clay?
Yeah, that's the other thing. Not only how does he fire it, how does he stand them up? He has like a couple of them are actually, well, one's in a chair, but one's like in full standing position.
Well, to be fair, you will note that, and I'm sure you didn't realize this, Max, and I can understand why. Your knowledge of things medical is not maybe as broad as some people's, but as soon as you stab a cat, it instantly goes into rigor mortis, so therefore...
I did not know that. I also have to say, he's trying to be nice. He's trying to get the cat out of the wall. Like, I'll get you out with this butcher knife that I will stab into the wall. That's not the best way to, like, crack plaster. But to be fair,
it's obvious that he's got nothing. What else has he got?
He has an omelet pan. He could use that.
You can't cut plaster with an omelet pan.
No, but you could bash it. You could break plaster with a pan. Yeah, but that would might
panic and upset the cat.
As opposed to shoving a knife into the wall?
I would still choose the knife over the omelet pan, but I will say my note as soon as that happened was, he killed a cat. Horrible movie. No stars.
That's the thing. That's one of the laws. You never kill the cat.
But we didn't see it until it became a stuffed toy. I mean, until it was dead.
Yeah. So,
it is one of the worst depictions of a quote-unquote dead cat I've ever seen. Although it actually could just be bad taxidermy because it's really bad. And as soon as we get Bert Convy, there he goes. He's down. Bert is down.
Yeah. By the way, Bert Convy, I don't even know his character's name. Who cares? I think it's Lou. Is the worst police officer in the world. He confronts Seymour. He has his gun drawn and pointed at him.
Which he shouldn't have.
Walter. And Walter takes him out with an omelet pan.
Well, to be fair, he shouldn't have drawn the gun, although he also, as an undercover cop, just had it stuffed in his pants, which Yeah. I think adds to your theory of his being a terrible undercover cop.
He's a terrible, terrible cop, and he gets killed way too easily.
Well, I couldn't even tell. So there's this cowboy looking sort of, I don't know, duster wearing guy thing who's there first. And he is obviously up to something because as soon as Bert comes in, he sneaks out and makes a phone call to somebody, but we don't even know who it is.
Yeah, to Lyle Lovett.
To Lyle Lovett.
That's who it looked like.
But we don't even know who it is. I thought it was a newspaper man.
No. And we don't see him again. No.
And then we were like, is Bert the guy he's watching? And it was a little confusing. Mm. And then we find out, oh no, Bert's a cop and they're working together. Okay. They're looking for the drug culture of the, I've never heard of such a thing. Drugs and beats? No.
And not to mention, my God, they're awfully free with it. I mean, there's that woman, Naolia, just goes over and goes, oh, Walter, I think you're great. I want to help you. Here, have some heroin.
Which apparently comes in a prescription bottle in easy-to-use pill fashion, which, to be fair, no idea how... I don't even know what heroin looks like. And
have some heroin pills.
Just so you know, here at Max Bite Movies, we do not in any way endorse think you should take drugs, especially horse, because as you well know, we have no horse here, just a pony. Which is not the same thing. So,
Basically, she gives him Flintstones chewable heroin.
Not even gummy style, but which I don't even know if you can do that. I don't even know what horse does.
It's a massive opioid. It makes it kills pain, sends you into a massive state of euphoria. It's normally a powder that you heat until it's a liquid, and then you inject it.
See, I guess there's one point I was watching Dragnet, and they were talking about tar heroin. So I always picture it as this thick black goo.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what tar... I don't know what black tar heroin is.
To me, if it was like in that form, like sort of fig paste, if you injected that, you would, what's the word, die. Because it would clog... Yeah, I don't understand drugs. I don't care.
I'm not sure how that works. Some people used to smoke it, too, although that would kill you pretty quickly. Yeah. But it's an injectable.
I wanted to add a line to the movie poster, which had said, "You'll sick, 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 you'll die of laughter." I wanted to add, "You will see gruesome off-screen murders," because...
Yeah, I gotta say, a lot of this, it's like, oh no, nudity, which we can't see because she's out of frame, and yes, horrible murder over there somewhere.
Well, we hear it, kind of.
Oh yeah, we hear it, and it's implied we don't really ever see anyone, get stabbed or strangled or even killed with an omelet pan.
Well, we do see, and apparently that smack to the head caused quite a open wound in Bert Convy, but whatever.
Yeah.
I will say, as dead bodies, everybody in this film sucked. Even when we only see Bert's hand, he falls out of the ceiling because somehow that was the best place to hide Bert Convy. All my Bert Convys go out in the shed, but his hand's
your
moving.
Convy shed.
You can see his hand
he's
moving.
He's moving.
And the woman Alice, too, like terrible dead body. I would say also, I agree with Dick Miller. The mannequins they use for the statues are...
Oh, boy. They're pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
And, I mean, I have to say, I think that Walter Paisley obviously has some kind of super strength. Because not only when he is stabbing the wall with the knife, they cut away, they cut back, and you see he has somehow cracked out like a 2-foot panel with like one blow. And he somehow, with no ladder and no chair to stand on, heaves Bert Convy's body into the ceiling by himself in a matter of seconds. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's, I don't know how he got up there either. Maybe he asked Bert to climb up there just before he passed away. I don't know.
Maybe.
Hey, I've got company. Could you, before you...
Mind hiding up there, please, while you bleed out?
Yeah,
thank
Bert,
you.
I really appreciate that.
I do appreciate it.
I can say, though, I really like the music, and I know it is also probably reused from somewhere else. I didn't see that listed anywhere, but I didn't like jazz until... Actually, it was your fault, because you and I went to go see Miles Away, the Miles Davis movie by Don Cheadle, which, if you have not seen it, I highly recommend.
It's really good. I'm not a jazz person either, but this is a really good
and
movie.
And this is a triple play, so he's writing, directing, and starring in it, and he does a great job. Mm-hmm. It was a little indie film that came out. We went and saw it, and they're playing a lot of music from one of Miles Davis's albums called Kind of Blue, and I was like, I don't like jazz. I hate jazz, but I kind of like that. And I started...
See, our entire episode on Wild
Boy. And I looked into it and ended up liking it. And, like, even the jazz in this or whatever they want to call it, I actually really liked it. And I thought it helped...
There's a little jazz. The rest, when we see that bozo with the guitar, who I really wanted to introduce to El Kabong, was... he's singing folk songs, again, which was more a very coffee house thing to do. I thought it was more hippie than beat, but sure. And, I mean, he's singing one, of course, in Spanish, and he's singing the very subtle Die, Murderer, Die, or whatever he'll die, Burn, Witcher, Burn, or whatever he's singing.
No, toss a coin to your witcher. That's what he was,
Sorry. Burn, Butcher, Burn.
Where won't we go next? Okay. Yeah, but it also felt, I didn't like him either, but it felt, again, like it.
It's appropriate. Yeah,
it belonged there. And I still want to go to that coffee shop. I really do. I don't even like coffee. I still want to go there.
Yeah, but did you also hear what they serve there?
I forget. What did they serve?
You know, wheat germ bagels.
Well, that means that Joey Ramone can go.
So, you know, everything is very clearly vegetarian and weird.
I was actually,
and they have not figured out how to do it well yet.
Well, and I was very surprised to hear that that kind of thing went back that far, you know?
Oh, so yeah. 59. No, that was a big thing.
I mean, because I know my grandmother, she really had a thing for, quote-unquote, natural food and like, I'm going to make and we still joke to this day about grandma's fuzzy carrots because she peeled carrots with a knife, not with a peeler. So she scraped the carrots and they had this texture to them that somehow made them, what's the word, terrible.
Yeah,
and she made us eat carob instead of chocolate because somehow... That was better.
Carob is just cruel. It's like, here, taste this. That will remind you you're not eating chocolate.
Yeah, so, whatever. But I was surprised that whole, you know, natural food thing went back as far as it did. Because all I ever see of the 50s was greasers and rock and roll and all the good stuff. And it's like, apparently this is going on too. So,
The beat movement was late. It was fairly late 50s, very early 60s. Like you say, it lasted about 5 minutes.
Yeah, but you see it all over the place. There were cartoons where it influenced. It shows up in other movies. And like people know about it and made fun of it for probably twice as long as it actually existed.
Oh, longer than that.
Although, to be fair, my beat poem, you have to admit, was really, really typical.
It was disturbingly on target. Yeah, well,
that took me 5 minutes.
I mean, no offense to Allen Ginsberg and the others, but bad beat poetry is really easy to make fun
of. And honestly, really fun to do.
Yeah. It's very easy to do bad beat poetry. It's pretty much like take a thesaurus and start flipping to random pages.
I did it all by myself. Just like this film. I will say at the end, I was trying to figure out, was DeSantis maybe trying to get Walter caught? It almost felt like I really wish they had fixed that character so we had a better idea, because that might have made things a little bit better or more understandable.
I mean, he's trying to redirect me, saying, no, you should do abstract art, not this realism, not this very obviously encased bodies. Because abstract art, you wouldn't have to murder anyone for, right?
Well, and to be fair, we're talking the 50s, so abstract expressionism is in its peak right now. You know, Jackson Pollock has died 4 years before. He was more or less crowned king of abstract expressionism. But it would go on for quite a while, and we wouldn't get figurative representation being popular in art back again till the 80s. I mean, I mean, it got more and more minimalist after this. You'd start getting, you know, this is the time where we'd gone from Pollock to, oh dear gods, I can't think of his name. The one guy who did the two, like he would have two big squares of color and that was it.
Oh, Kandinsky?
No. Although he's in Mondrian? There somewhere too. No, Mondrian's earlier. He's actually Steve? French. No.
Not Steve?
I can't think of his name. No, it's not Steve.
I'm pretty sure it's Steve.
But and then lots of other minimalists would start going through the 60s and 70s until the 80s. We get, you know, more representational work. But yeah, the fact that he's doing quote unquote realistic depictions is surprising that they're going for it that much. But
I thought it was interesting when the Maxwell Brock is going when. Is putting down abstract art. I thought that would be a big thing.
Me too, because one of the whole things behind abstract art was the expression of emotion without depiction. It was just, you're supposed to see how I feel, and that's not necessarily a concrete anything. So I was a little surprised too, although most of the art that's hanging in the coffee house it straddles that line between abstract and not very good. Yeah, where it's like, yeah. Oh, it's abstract because I can't draw hands, you know, kind of way.
Yeah, it's so. The kind of art that where the artists can excuse it. Well, you just don't get it, man. Like, yeah, no, you just have no talent, man.
Oh, I get it. You just can't do it. Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, that was just part of the whole ambiance of this film. French, the way that Maison de Velour is French.
I have to say that one of the many problems I had with Walter's character, he goes from accidental killer to full-on serial killer really easily.
He does, and I wish there had been I think there's a hint, again, I'm going to go with off-camera, of him actually losing sanity. And but
we don't see it.
No, we don't. And they could have easily done more with it. And I think, again, you could easily have made this a Poe-like or Lovecraftian-type story with a little work and probably another $50,000.
Other authors, including, I think, Lovecraft, have done things about artists going mad and committing horrible acts for their art.
And luckily, including some racism in along with it.
Oh, yeah, that too, especially Lovecraft. But a lot that is a very big trope in both gothic horror and supernatural horror from the earlier parts of the century.
Yeah, but the question is, does that lacking affect our enjoyment of the film or not? I'm out of notes here, Max. What about you? Do you want to find out if we...
Let's bring it home. The finish.
So, Max.
Yeah.
I actually know the answer to this. You've never seen Bucket of Blood because the title alone is enough to make you go, I don't want to see that.
Yeah, I'm not big into horror movies, so no, I've never seen this.
So, do you mind if I ask where you watched it?
I got a copy from the library as part of the Corman collection. It was like a multi-disc set of like 6 or 8 Corman movies.
Oh, so not a collection, it's a smattering of
Corman. Yes, a smattering.
Because as we pointed out, he produced 300
films. Yes! Yeah, you could not. You would need an entire library for him.
You cannot lift the core man.
Yeah. Build up your core man strength.
Yeah. I would like to know, what did you think of, I think I can guess. What did you think of Bucket of Blood?
I think we should have seen this before A Little Shop, because this came out, a year before it?
Okay.
Technically, it's earlier. Because all I could think the whole thing is, this is Corman's ripping off himself. Again, I agree. I think the acting was acceptable. I thought the script was unbelievably weak. I don't think it's very good. I do like the beat setting because, as you say, we don't really get a lot of it. We get people making fun of it, and I guess that's what's happening here. But the beat cafe was the most fun. That's where the few lines that are almost amusing happen.
Almost amusing. There's fan praise.
That's pretty much it. So, no, I thought... And it's very short. This thing's like 1 hour and 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it feels longer.
He had $50,000.
Yeah. That's all right. That's more than he had for some of his others. But not very few of his movies go more than, 1 hour and 20?
Something like
there
that.
There are some. I mean,
Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yes, well, that just felt like it was 4 hours long. But I don't know. It's not horrendous, and it's also not one of those that's so bad it's funny. It's just meh.
Yeah.
I think. What about you? Now, you also had never seen this, right?
No, I'm sure I'd heard the title. Yeah. I honestly put it alongside Herschel Gordon Lewis's 10,000 Maniacs and other things that were much more gory. Like, I thought this
was going to be... Yeah, that's what I assumed when I heard the title.
So I'd never had an interest in it either. Yeah. That being said, I think I liked it better than you did.
Huh.
Here's the thing. Do I think it's a good movie? No. Again, it's very short, so it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, it's not a huge amount of time. And I got to say, this has been a really refreshing series because we've been tackling some really long films in previous series, and it was kind of nice to just be like, oh, yeah, I can fit this in between a couple of loads of laundry. I'll be fine. I think that there's some really good potential here. And I don't know if the entire answer is money. I think there's some definite time and some talent. I mean, let's face it, Charles Griffith has written a bunch of other Corman films to various levels of quality.
Mm.
And Corman himself has done more with less, I think. So I'm going to give it a pass only because I think there's some interesting ideas. And again, the beat culture, we don't get to see it. If somebody else knows a film that actually has a depiction of real beat culture,
I'd be interested to know that.
Or taken seriously, I'd love to see it because I have a kind of weird fascination with it. It's not a good time for, women, probably other races besides white people, people who love poetry. But I still have a kind of weird fascination with it, and I'd really like to see something that was of the time and portrayed positively. And that's why I couldn't tell. I think they honestly found beat culture hilarious, and that's why they play it straight. It's like, oh no, it's funny, just watch it. And that's why it kind of bombs as a comedy, because I didn't think it was that funny. I would actually like to see more of it. I think the basic idea of a man killing people and encasing them in clay is very sort of classic gothic horror, and if it had been developed that way, could even have been really effective. I don't want to see the 1995 remake. I don't need to see a musical version of this. I think that the people who decided to do that did it right with Little Shop of Horrors. Maybe Beatsville will be good. I don't know, but I didn't think of it being the same plot, basic plot, as Little Shop. So technically, Little Shop rips this off. But we know Little Shop, and we don't need another one. So I'm going to say, if you have any interest in old 50s drive-in movie horror films, sure, why not? It's only an hour. Who cares? But Corman's done better, and I'm hoping we'll do better. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck watching some really lousy films for the rest of the series.
I do have to say, by the way, while we make fun of the beat poetry and such, there were giants who came out of that.
Sure.
You know, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac.
They just tended to be horrible human beings.
Well,
misogynistic But yeah. Mm. But not only that, poll question. You like my segue there? Very, very smooth. So we still have a new poll question because that's what we do every week at this time. And we want to know, what genre do you think mixes best with comedy? What kind of cinematic cocktail would you make if comedy was your main booze? There. Oh, that's right. I'm not supposed to make metaphors anymore, am I?
No, you've had your metaphor privileges revoked.
Oh, well, I'll try to do better. And I'll do better by contacting us at maxmikemovies.com, which suggests that, yes, we do have a website, maxmikemovies.com, where you can find all of our episodes, previous series. You can search if you're looking to see if we've done a particular film. Admittedly, 294 episodes plus specials is a lot to look through. If you type in the name of the movie, you can find if we did an episode.
Yep.
You can also go to Facebook, where we are Max Mike Movies. You can answer our poll question there, leave us comments, give us ideas for future series, movies we should watch. Heck, that show 300 is still up for grabs. We have an idea, but if y'all give us something better, we may go ahead and shift. And last but not least, if there's a podcast app, probably we're on it. If there's going to be a podcast app, which later, a week later, gets pulled because of some sort of contractual issue, we'll still probably be there as Max Mike Movies. But we still have a few films to go in this here series of Be Like the Corman, Max. How next week are we going to be like the Corman?
We will live like the Corman. Love like the Corman. Well, we're going back, at least not that far back from this one, but we're going back to my childhood. This was a Corman movie I remember seeing on like a Saturday or Sunday afternoon when I was young. And I remember really liking it, because it was like, this is the first cinematic depiction of a wizard duel I had ever seen outside of a cartoon. No, there is no talking dog and no meddling kids.
Oh, rats.
But this is another Poe sort of adaptation.
Okay.
If you stand on one foot, close one eye, and hit yourself in the head with a hammer. It is called The Raven.
And cool.
We have a hell of a cast in this. We have Boris Karloff. We have Vincent Price. We have Peter Lorre and a young Jack Nicholson. So I am really nervous as to how it will hold up, because I loved it when I was a kid.
Wait, you're going to make us watch a film with that limey cocksucker?
thank you, Bella. He is Hungarian. He is double jointed.
Garl of that limey cocksucker.
Okay, that's very good.
I know two beeps
now,
for me.
Yeah, I'll give you a third. Okay, that's good. Now say Boris Karloff is a cocksucker.
Well, join us next week. Nevermore.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.